my career with the National League. Bart Giamatti was an old friend of mine when he left Yale and became president of the National League. He called me up. He had disciplinary responsibilities, and he realized there were a few problems that he came across that a physicist might address. So he called me up one evening and said that he asked me to be a consultant to the league. And he'd have his lawyers would draw up a contract, and I would be paid, you know, 0.1% of what Mark McGwire makes, which is still a lot of money. And I wasn't sure I wanted to get tied up with it, and I wasn't sure what I could do. So I said, oh, hell, Bart, this is too much fun. I don't want to go that way. Just tell me what you want. And he then gave me a few rather well-defined questions. And I wrote then, I found it quite interesting. And I wrote little reports for that were designed for an intelligent layman. Bart was an English professor, not a technical person. And he was very pleased, and he wanted to reward me. Well, I'd already turned down money. So, but being a master of English professor, a master of metaphor and figures of speech and knowing the power of words, he gave me this lovely title, which just charmed the 10-year-old boy in me. And that's how I became the first ever, and I expect probably the last ever, official physicist to the National League. Well, in thinking about baseball, one of the things that interested me is the difference between a very fastball pitcher and just a good fastball pitcher. And I could go back to a conversation I had with a softball pitcher who played serious softball. And at the he said that at one time, the distance from the softball plate to softball rubber to the plate was 44 feet. And the batters just didn't have a chance. Then they moved it to 45 feet, and the batters did a lot better. And now it's at 46 feet, and said, now it's a very even game. The batters have a real chance. And I said, 44 feet, 45 feet, 46 feet? How could that make so much difference? And in the same sense, then I worry about, or concern myself about, how the good big league pitchers nowadays, most of them throw with muzzle velocities of over 90 miles an hour, perhaps up in the low 90s, and the superb fast, the real fastball pitchers, some of the closers, and I think the as starting pitchers, I think the nonpareil is Randy Johnson, throw with muzzle velocities of over 100 miles an hour. And but still, we're talking about a 5% effect. How can that make so much difference? So I'd like to start. So I started trying to think about the timing of all of this in baseball. Now, a long time ago, I used to play rarely a bar game. And the bar game is catch the dollar bill. And you take a new dollar bill, so it's fairly straight, or you bend it a little, and your friend drops the dollar bill. You put your fingers right there and try to catch it as he drops it. Of course, I know when I started to drop it, so I could catch it. I didn't want to have a dollar floating around here. I'm of Scotch ancestry. So, and if you catch the bill, you get the dollar, and if you don't, you buy the next drink. That was a long time ago. It'd have to be a $10 bill now with inflation, but... And what happened is I could never catch the bill, and most people can't. I have had come with some people who could catch it, but most people can't. And you look into the timing, and you're talking about 150 milliseconds. Now, the time that Randy Johnson's, not Randy Johnson, but the good fastball pitcher, from the time he lets go of the ball till it crosses the plate, the front edge of the plate where the ball's hit, is about 400 milliseconds. So I'm interested then in how that 400 milliseconds translates to physiological times, and I've just made the first statement that the trivial thing like catching the dollar bill is 150 milliseconds. If we want to be a little more scientific, you can just say, well, blink your eye if you see that flash of light, and you can time that. That's experimental psychologists do that. And that times about 150 milliseconds again, same as catching the dollar bill. If you blow a blast of air in your eye, that's only 50 milliseconds. Your eye will automatically blink. But if you know now from neurophysiology and so forth, that signal doesn't even go to the brain. That just goes to the blink muscles, in a sense, more or less directly. And so we have some insight into what happens. Now I'd like to say a little about how the nervous system handles that, because that'll give us a few insights. Maybe I could show this right away. I'll bring this one back. That'll strangle myself on this cord. And so here we have the pitcher and the batter, and I have the distance here and the time. Here is the eye blink, 150 milliseconds. So you see that the batter has about 2.5 eye blinks time to hit the ball. And I'll go back to that. But I'd like to say a little about then the neurophysiology. Here is a cartoon. I better put it so we can all read it. Here is a cartoon of a nerve cell. We have a center nucleus of the cell, which is typically somewhere between, it varies, there's a lot of variation in different nerve cells, but maybe between 20, 50, sometimes even as large as 100 microns. Then there is a wire, an axon, which goes out, which carries a signal. These signals are standard signals, about 1 millisecond long and about a tenth of a volt. And that's what we run our internal computer on, also the signals sent to the muscles and so forth. And now in this system now, we have this signals bifurcate into a lot of other nerve cells. And then signals from the nerve cells come into this nerve cell. These are through dendrites. And we not only have signals which act as coincidences, so if we get a lot of plus signals in here, we're going to fire a signal off this axon, but we also have anti-coincidences. Now in electronics, the kind of physics that Al Nathan and I spent wasted years of our life doing, rather before we got involved in baseball, we call these voter coincidence circuits. That we have a signal is sent out depending on the summation of positive signals coming in and negative signals coming in. And that is the fundamental unit of our central nervous system. And how many of them are there? There's around 100 billion of these things, and they have about 100 trillion connections. On the other hand, they're slow. This is a million times slower. Our characteristic time is like 2 milliseconds to do anything. While your home computer at 500 megahertz, it's about 2 nanoseconds. It's a million times different. So we have a computer which is a million times smaller, but roughly speaking, is a million times more units. And so what we do here, we can't calculate. This is a terrible we're terrible calculators. We go up to 10 on our fingers, and we could probably have to down there take off our shoes to go further than that. But we are marvelously good at pattern recognition, and there's a whole cottage industry of neural networks. John Hopfield has contributed especially to this sort of thing. But this gives us an idea of how the mind works. We're very good at patterns, but we're not very good at any kind of computing. Now let's take a look back here, and I'd like to say something about, we can first start out by the ball leaves here, and now we have to look at the ball. We have to make some kind of projection as to where the ball's going to go. Let us say, for the sake for this exposition for the moment, that when the ball is 1/4 of the way to the plate, then we'll find out that we have to make some serious decisions on what we're going to do. So this is 100 milliseconds has passed, the ball has traveled only about 14 feet, you're batting here, and it's now that you've pretty well got to decide whether you're going to swing or not. And then what happens? Well, you have to look at the ball. You have to see. And the whole business of the optic nerve and of the ocular system, we have about a hundred million rods and cones. Each are receptors. There are three layers of nerves processing that. So it's processed information that goes to about a million of our axons, which move along to the brain. And that processing time to get the signals out there takes the order of 20 milliseconds. There's three layers. Everything takes 2 or 3 milliseconds. Then it travels to the brain. The rate at which these things travel along the nerve fibers, they'll go maybe even 100 meters per second, but not for these. And the signal has to go to the back of the brain. Here's where we process the stuff back here. So it takes us a solid 30 milliseconds to see a picture. And you can think of then this time as a number of individual pictures. Actually, it's continuous, but it's a number of individual pictures. So then after you see this, one's going to have to, after looking, will take about the 75 milliseconds. That's to then take the signal, see it, and make the processing back here. That'll take about 75 milliseconds, 30 milliseconds to see it, 20 milliseconds to get there, and then some patterns formation. Very slow, but everything in parallel. We have these zillions of cells all working together, and that'll take then about 75 milliseconds to make the picture. Then what do? You have the picture. You're batting, you have the picture. Well, you can't compute. You have to compare it with pictures that you have stored from your experience. And finally, a picture comes up. You look through all of these. You may be presupposed. Before you get up, you say, oh, this guy's a fastball pitcher. Or like Dave Baldwin, this guy throws right-handed off of his shoe tops. That's tricky. I've not seen much of that. I haven't gotten any pictures stored like that, which was why Dave did so well. But anyway, you're looking through this whole store of pictures. And you're very slow, but you do all of this in parallel. You've got zillions of things working in parallel. And so you have about 50 milliseconds, that 20, a half of that, is taken to finding the right picture. So you find the right picture. This is a fastball over the inside corner. Now you have to go to another part of the brain yet, and that picks up actions. That picks up the swing of the bat. You have learnt the swing of the bat. You've learnt the swing of the bat like you learned to tie your shoes. Did you ever try to think how your fingers move when you're tying your shoes? Don't. You'll never tie your shoes again. So you have this swing. And now it goes to a thing where it says, okay, this is a swing over, we'll take the line drive swing, we'll swing, I have a level swing with such and such a timing over the inside of the plate. That'll exhaust this 50 milliseconds. Now, this signal, okay, you got this. It's all churned out. You got the whole set of neurons firing your cables down your spinal column, down to your legs and arms and everything. Well, that takes a while to get there. It doesn't happen instantaneously. Another 25 milliseconds. And now swinging the bat takes 150 milliseconds itself. Let me just sort of comment on swinging the bat. Here's the bat as a function of time, where I have the bat and the velocity. So when the ball crosses the plate, as Al Nathan pointed out, the bat's going around 70 miles an hour. And you hit the bat right in front of the plate. 50 milliseconds before, the bat is still going about two-thirds of that, about 50 miles an hour, back here someplace. And 100 milliseconds before that, you're really sort of starting out the swing. Now, the bat, at 50 milliseconds before the ball hits the bat, there's not much you can do about it. That bat is traveling very fast. That's almost the last point at which you can affect the bat. 100 milliseconds before then, you can affect the bat a fair amount. You start at the swing, but you can say, ooh, that ball's coming in a little closer, so you can draw in a little. Or that ball's coming a little higher, and that's harder. You could try to lift up. Maybe you hit a higher pop fly or something. You can do something about it. You can probably even check your swing at 100 milliseconds while you started back here at zero. So now we can see then, back where our timing curves, to get some idea of what one can do. So this is where you start the swing. You have to start by what you see then 100 milliseconds afterwards. So you have to start the swing when the ball's only gone about 15 feet. And if you calculate just the acuity of the eye and so forth, you can see that there's a lot of information, a detailed information you can't have. You can't tell where the ball's going to go within a few inches on a straight ball, and a curve, it's almost a disaster. You really have got to sort of outguess the curve. So that goes into where you have to start the swing. Let's consider where you can still affect the swing appreciably is this 50 milliseconds. So now all the information you're getting from the eye up to 150 milliseconds, that can be still used to modify the swing. You can still change things to some extent. Then you're here. All these processes have to be modified. They're all going along simultaneously. Well, what about then waiting another 50 milliseconds? That will be the last point you can affect the swing. So after the 50 milliseconds before the bat hits the ball, there isn't anything you can do about it. You've put all that energy into it. You don't even have the strength to change. You can't check the swing. You can't really do much of anything. Now we can go back along our chain, and we see that all of the decisions you made, everything you've seen about the ball, every information you can use, has been from the first half of the ball crossing the plate. Now, if you close your eyes at this point, I wouldn't want to do this psychologically. That would be a hard thing to do. But you'll hit the ball just as well if you close your eyes. Or if you're playing indoor at night in one of these dome stadiums and there's a power failure as the ball goes halfway there, you'll hit the ball just as well. This is a fastball, 400 milliseconds. Now let's say you have Randy Johnson or some of these big guys who pitch, who throw the ball 15 times in the last inning of the game, because that's their quota. But they throw it very, very, very hard. And this is now not 400 milliseconds, but 375 milliseconds. Well, look, now you're going to have to start back here. You're not doing a 5% effect. You're doing about a 25% effect. And so the real extreme fastball pitchers, it's not just the ratio of the time it takes for the ball to cross the plate. It's much more than that. Because so much of the time on a normal pitch is required for all of the decisions, bat swinging, and so forth, you have to do. Now, in all of this, I'm going to change the subject just slightly. In all of this, all of these patterns that you're looking for, before you go up the bat, you can do some pre-selection. So some of them, let's say, are on top of the layers. And so if you're going up against a fastball pitcher or a left-handed pitcher, you think about that a bit. Oh, yeah, he's left-handed. He throws a good fastball, or he throws a slider. I better watch the dot. Dave tells us about the red dot on top of the ball that you can see on a slider. All those things, you're thinking about that. And that brings patterns up to the top, so they get at a little quicker. So you do think about this, and it all goes back, of course, to your training. You've trained yourself. You've had a lot of practice. You've swung that bat thousands of times against different balls. You have a lot of patterns stored in there. But now, just before you go up the bat, the manager comes to you and says, don't swing at any bad ones, but don't let any good ones go by. And don't hit the ball on the ground. Jones is on first. He can't run. And if the ball's on the inside, pull it, but otherwise hit it where you should, and you're listening to all of this, and then you go up to the plate and you got all these things going around, and you come back afterwards after the third strike's called and you watch it go by and said, that was right in my hitting zone, but somehow I couldn't pull the trigger. So you have to think when you bat, but not too much. Well, the umpire has much the same problem. I think a more interesting thing are things like curveballs and knuckleballs. And you begin to see why in a knuckleball, the batter cannot hit the knuckleball and the catcher can't even catch it. Because as some of the work, which is actually it's in Bayhill and Watts' book, and talks about experiments done by Bayhill's colleague, Mr. Watts, shows how sharp a knuckleball can change. They show one, which is maybe the knuckleball of the year. It both goes in and out, and the changes are in under the 150 milliseconds, so they are not possible to hit it, and it is not possible even to catch it. I find that interesting.
But can you tell whether it's a strike?
Umpires are a law in themselves. I can talk about it. I think they have, there's problems there too, but that's another story.
How much of a factor do you think are differences in visual acuity of big league players? We talked about Ted Williams. Eyesight really a factor?
Well, I think the eyesight's a factor. I think good eyesight. But I'm not sure. There have been a few good hitters who didn't have terribly good eyesight. Some of them, because they could take the center of the blur well. I expect it bothered them more in picking up. And Dave, I've known about some of this. I was very interested to hear Dave Baldwin talk about some of it at lunch, where all of the pitchers look at the configuration of the ball. They have all kinds of clues. The batter takes all kinds of clues, just the way the hand he sees and all that. And their good eyesight could make a difference. How many fingers do you see? Do you see, as the ball is spinning, do you see patterns of white spots and red spots and so forth? All of that, the visual acuity, must be fairly important. But Dave knows much more about this than I do.
Yes, are there ways to electronically simulate being pitched to so that one can develop a hand-eye coordination given today's technology that's available?
I would have to go to my wife, who's a physiologist now, was trained in experimental psychology, and I would have to ask her. Here she is. Do you want to say something? She says no. I don't know.
Thank you.